Welcome to Rocking Our Prayers. I'm Dr. Alice Evans. Now, for centuries, millions of African people were captured and coerced into slave trades. The Saharan trade, the Red Sea trade, the Indian Ocean trade, and the transatlantic trade all plundered and exported enslaved people. 12 million were taken from Africa to the Americas. A further 6 million were exported in other trades. As many were coerced into inland slavery under Islamic states. 300 years of intensive slave raiding led to predatory states and pervasive insecurity. Now, how did continuous conflict affect solidarity and status? Economic historians usually analyse the impact of slave raiding in the past 500 years, but this can blind us to underlying conditions. If we trace cultural evolution over the very long run, we see that sub-Saharan Africa's geography generated strong demand for labour. The slave trades then amplified the returns to slave raiding and heightened militarisation. Now, continuous conflict may have encouraged co-ethnic solidarity and respect for strong men. The transatlantic slave trade disproportionately took young men, leaving women to be enslaved as concubines in the Islamic states. This has resulted in very high rates of polygamy, which obstructs gender equality through early marriage, high fertility, intimate partner violence, and intergroup conflict. The Gulf of Guinea was most hard hit by the transatlantic slave trade and is overwhelmingly ruled by men. Okay, so let's take a step back and think about what encouraged state formation. Peter Turchin argues that large empires formed on the steppe frontier as settled farmers organised to protect themselves from attacks by nomadic pastoralists. In Newark, Volker Chanyish similarly argues that slave raiding in Eastern Europe encouraged defensive state formation. So now, you may wonder, well, why didn't slave raiding lead to strong states in Africa? Well, a brilliant new paper by David Schoenholzer and Pieter François reveals the importance of circumscription. They calculate the global heterogeneity in circumscription by computing the differences between the agricultural productivity of one cell compared to all the surrounding cells. In the Nile Valley, farming was excellent, while exit options were terrible. Circumscription was high. Further south, in Nubia, land was more arid and circumscription was low. Now, they find that cooperation, conflict, and state formation emerge much more quickly and much more typically in rich ecologies with weak exit options. Public goods, defences, irrigation, food storage, currency, and trade were also much more common among pre-state societies located in circumscribed regions. So now, this makes me think, well, what about ancient Egypt and ancient Nubia? In mid-4th millennium BCE, Egyptians adopted ploughs and oxen. Owners of these new technologies were increasingly able to command the labour of those without. Dependent on the Nile's alluvial floodplain, they could not escape. Strong states organised large-scale industries and construction. Egypt's great pyramids were built by armies of corvée labourers, fed by mass-produced bread and beer. Further south, the Khmer Kingdom ruled from 2700 BC to 1500 BC. But there's little evidence of complex administration, huge granary storage, or territorial fortifications, explains David Wenker. Writing, a major instrument of state control, came much later. Egyptians developed hieroglyphics in 2700 BC, but the Meroitic script emerged 2,000 years later and was mostly confined to the royal court. Trade fairs were only hosted seasonally at Hafirs, those artificial catchment basins. They were built alongside temples. Autonomous tribes moved with their herds. So what explains this divergence between Egypt and Nubia? The Middle Nile's alluvial floodplains were rather sparse. Semi-arid lands favoured pastoralism, suggests David Wenker. Since Nubian herders moved with their cattle, they were much harder to tax, and that inhibited coercive state formation. Weaker state defences also made Nubians much more vulnerable, so they were repeatedly raided for livestock and slaves. Ancient Egypt was much more circumscribed and saw the emergence of both cooperation, coercion, and state formation. So the Kermit Kingdom was far less centralized and continually raided for slaves. And that fits Schoenholzer and Francois' broader finding that states were less likely to emerge in regions where agricultural productivity was more uniform. Now, as you know, across sub-Saharan Africa, agricultural productivity was generally low. So if we revisit Schoenholzer and Francois' data, we see that sub-Saharan Africa's agricultural productivity, it was just undifferentiated. Circumscription was extremely low. Great kingdoms did emerge, but they usually exercised weaker control over their peripheries. So given the abundance of fairly uniform land, people may have preferred to escape and evade centralizing control. And so that likely discouraged state formation. So African rulers prioritize control over people. Africans have traditionally valued what Daniel Jordan Smith calls wealth in people. Labor and capital were scarce, while land was abundant. Low population density made it much harder and more important to control people. The tsetse fly is pervasive from the Sahara to the Kalahari. It infects and spreads disease in cattle, sheep, goats, camels, and horses. The dearth of draft animals likely raised the importance of human labor as substitutes. So African rulers then faced a distinctive challenge, argued Jeffrey Herbst. Rather than seeking territorial expansion, they prioritized command over labor. Wars were waged to raid slaves. 4th century stone inscriptions attest to Axumite kings' military conquests, seizing slaves and livestock. In the 8th century, the Zagawa, that's close to Lake Chad, traded slaves to Muslims further north in exchange for horses, which they used for more slave raiding. In the 9th and 10th centuries, the Kingdom of Ghana similarly raided slaves, which it sold along with gold to Muslim merchants. So pre-colonial African rulers' greatest threats was not necessarily international conquest, but domestic rebellion. Power was concentrated at the center, while peripheries were usually delegated to local governors. Historian Richard Reed likens pre-colonial African empires to the spokes of a rimless wheel. Now, when Arabs and Europeans initially tried to centralize control in Africa before the 1880s, they failed. State weakness was therefore not a function of culture, but African geography, argues Jason Sharman. In 1590, the Moroccan Sultanate failed to conquer the Songhai Kingdom. Local Moroccan leaders became too independent and developed autonomous slave-raiding ventures. In southern Africa, the Boers escaped the control of the Dutch East India Company and the British Crown to forge independent republics. In Angola and Mozambique, the Portuguese struggled to maintain local alliances. So before the 1850s, the South Central African ruling families exercised independent control with their own slave armies, the Chikunda. Let me quote Jason Sharman again. He says, obedience to the Portuguese authorities became a polite fiction. And later, even this pretense was dropped, along with Christianity, European dress, family relations, Portuguese language and literacy. Now, then came the transatlantic demand for slaves, and this enabled African rulers to build more predatory states. From the late 1600s, there was a major external rise in the demand for slaves to work on American plantations. Sugar, tobacco, and cotton were extremely labor-intensive. Due to deaths in transit, horrific abuse, disease, and low production, that all sustained high demand for more victims. So because so many people died in slavery in the slave trade, they needed more and more slaves. Rising transatlantic demand for slaves gave African rulers opportunities to use external resources to build predatory states by purchasing foreign guns, conscripting slave soldiers, and using foreign revenue. Rulers could pay off subordinates and export more slaves. States became even more extractive. Jason Sharman suggests that the transatlantic demand for slaves enabled African rulers to build predatory states from the outside in. So warfare against outsiders was the primary means of generating wealth. Elsewhere in the world, rulers encouraged internal production, which they then taxed to build armies and counter foreign threats. As Tilly famously quipped, war made the state and the state made war. State building was inside out in Europe. So why didn't African rulers tax agriculture? Well, as I was saying before, generally soils had low productivity. Capital was scarce, as we know from Gareth Austin, and free farmers could easily escape to farm other land. So slave raiding for export was much more profitable. Now, Western demand then fueled enslavement on plantations in Africa. As Europe and North America industrialized, so did their demand for palm oil, peanuts and cotton. That created more opportunities for slave plantation agriculture in Africa. So although jihadi movements rose up to overthrow Muslim enslavers, they themselves institutionalized similar economies, as we know from Paul Lovejoy. And if slave women were taken as wives or concubines, their children had more legitimate claims to be free under Islam. And that generated relentless demand for more slaves by Islamic caliphates. So Paul Lovejoy estimates that slavery in the Muslim states of Sokoto Caliphate, Futa Jalon and Futu Toro went on to surpass slavery in the Americas. So if we want to understand the full impact of slave raiding in Africa, we need to incorporate that which was caused by the Islamic states in the Gulf of Guinea. So while Nathan Nunn and Leonard Wanchekon make an extremely valuable contribution by calculating slave exports using coastline shipping data, as well as foreign markets in Jeddah, Sudan and Bombay, West Africans' total slave raiding may be really underestimated. So slave raiding was incessant and there was endemic insecurity. Predatory military states used slave armies in order to raid and capture more slaves. Warfare was a primary means of generating wealth, especially under adverse climatic shocks. War was ramped up over hunting grounds, competing to capture more slaves. And, the primary producer of slaves during the transatlantic slave trade was conflict between ethnic groups. Conquered people would either be directly exported or forced to pay ongoing tribute in slaves. West African states and societies became especially militarized. Any society that stopped exporting trades, slaves, would have less revenue and become more vulnerable to capture. In the Niger River Valley, young men were conscripted as slave soldiers, while women were forced to farm. According to a French observer in the 1880s, there was, and I quote, incessant warfare to capture women, children, and young men to sell them. In Sorodou, that's Burkina Faso, another French observer reported, "There is a shocking anarchy reigning in the Samu County. The pathways are not safe. One ventures out with one's bow and arrows and returns with booty, the product of banditry. Unfortunately, the Diola coming from the Bandiagara encouraged this unstable situation by buying captives. For one cow or one bar of salt, a jeweler can purchase a slave, who was probably captured the day before in a neighbouring village." By 1840, 40% of the population of Zanzibar were slaves, usually captured by Arabs for the Sultanate. Constant predation spawned endemic insecurity. Terrified people sometimes escaped to hide in the tropical forest, abandoning their crops. Equatorial Africa suffered from incessant slave raiding, especially from Darfur. Manhunting, chasse à l'homme, continued under French colonialism. The French wanted porters to carry their heavy loads, but Africans resisted, so the French relied on labour coercion. The French also recruited non-local guards, who they did not properly feed, and these guards plundered villages en route to expropriate food and rape local women, tying them together at the neck. This is a colonial officer observed this, and this is quoted in Louisa Lombard's book on the Central African Republic. He says, He gets himself by Tipoi, demands 5 or 6 chickens for his daily food, and beats the natives when they do not do anything that fully pleases or satisfies him. Father Joseph Daigre, a missionary in Banda County, observed, and I quote, again this is from Louisa Lombard, "Auxiliaries behave like police and hunt all the gatherers who try to escape all the ordeal. It is common to see long lines of prisoners, naked and in a pitiful state, being dragged along by a rope by their necks. Countless poor wretches are taken along remoter roads, completely stupefied by the harsh treatment. They are famished, sick, and fall down like flies. They're really ill, and little children are left in little villages to die of starvation. Several times I found regions where the people least affected killed the ones who were dying for food." End quote. Terrified people fled their villages, explains Louisa Lombard. In 1896, Emile Gentil remarked upon Manza's immense millet and manioc plantations. 4 years later, adventurous Fernand Ferou only saw rot. A colonial officer complained, "We track them in the bush, where they prefer to seek refuge and die of hunger rather than carry our loads." Now, how did 300 years of slave raiding impact culture? Well, there are likely going to be long-run cultural effects, and a key study here is by Nathan Nunn and Leonardo Wanchekon. They find that Africans who distrusted each other may have been more likely to evade capture and then socialize their children to be distrustful. Today, distrust of relatives, neighbours and local government remains higher in places that suffered intensive raiding. Relatedly, Watley and Gilezu find that slave exports are strongly correlated with more ethnic groupings today. The Gulf of Guinea suffered most severely from the transatlantic slave trade due to its physical proximity to the Americans and now has acute ethnic divisions, stratification and distrust. Colonial borders may have amplified these effects, grouping multiple ethnicities into large states. Alessina and colleagues introduced the term artificial states for places where, and I quote, "political borders do not coincide with a division of nationalities desired by people on the ground." And I would add, it's not so much about the imposition of political borders, but also weak states and the dearth of public goods, which we know are fundamental for nation building. See work by Edward McGuell and also David Wimler. Okay, so existing studies suggest that slave raiding amplified distrust and differences while strengthening ethnicity. How can we make sense of those findings? So I suggest that slave raiding likely encouraged ethnic fraternity. Groups may have been more likely to survive and evade capture if they had strong fraternal solidarity. Weapons alone were no safeguard, since any one man could have prospered by turning on his neighbours and selling them as slaves. After that, the group would have become smaller and unable to mobilise defence. Large groups are key, but these could only have been maintained if every man downplayed his individual advantage and prioritised the group. I suggest that men united in loyalty would have been more likely to survive as a cohesive group. So fraternal solidarity is really fundamental due to men's biological advantage in warfare. Testosterone is 5 to 20 times higher in males, especially young males. And testosterone promotes muscle development during puberty. So this is why males generally have greater body strength and pack a more powerful punch. Testosterone is also associated with violent aggression. But that's not static. It surges with competition and success. So as a result, the fighting forces which protected the entire group were almost always men. Group survival really depended on brotherhood. So ethnic groups wage war to amass wealth, gain honour and protect their people. Dahomey, Asante and Yoruba city states competed against each other. Historian Richard Reed details that faith and identity both drove these wars and were called into service to justify them. So while others have highlighted distrust and divisions between groups, I think we need to think about the power of ethnic brotherhood. Groups with stronger bonds may have been more likely to survive because they sacrificed self-interest to maintain group strength. Dahomey was an exception. Its army of 12,000 to 15,000 included female soldiers. 5,000 were under female commanders, but that was unusual. Other armies were overwhelmingly male. Now, none of this negates women's important contributions as mothers, nor does it deny importance of wider social cohesion. My point is that in times of inter-ethnic war, groups really benefit from fraternal solidarity. Now, cultural traits that were advantageous during the centuries of violent slave raiding may persist today if surviving parents encourage their sons to look after their own, band together as brothers, and build supportive networks. Peers can also strengthen club-like solidarity by punishing those who show excessive loyalty to outsiders. Now, none of this is inconsistent with Nan and One Chekron. Ethnicity is a selective form of solidarity within a wider context of distrust. Okay, here's my second suggestion. Slave raiding may have raised co-ethnic men's status. In her brilliant book On Status, Cecilia Ridgway theorizes that groups gain status when they are seen as making valuable contributions to the group. At football matches, fans cheer for their superstar players who score the most points. And when the Kaiser City Chiefs won the Super Bowl, fans mob to celebrate their heroes. Likewise in law firms, praise is lavished on partners who secure lucrative clients. Alexei Stakhanov was a Soviet miner, heralded as a hero of socialist labor because he supposedly mined 227 tons of coal in a single shift. So if a group has high status, this means they're treated with respect and deference. Their words carry more weight and they're seen as leaders. Low status groups, meanwhile, are expected to serve and be subservient. Now, in certain times and places, African women did exercise spiritual power and moral authority. Learning from oral histories, Nwando Achebe reveals women's importance as goddesses, priestesses, oracles, deities, and queen mothers. Cosmology upheld gender complementarity. The Asante, Igbo, and Yoruba also had dual sex systems of governance. Women had independent networks and separate spheres of influence. Markets in the Gulf of Guinea were controlled by women who set the rules and punished the wrongdoers. But I suggest that during endemic slave raiding, co-ethnic men may have gained status. Like almost all wars, African wars were primarily waged by men. Military strategy and warfare were overwhelmingly orchestrated by men. Victory brought honor and celebrations. Richard Reed suggests that military prowess was the surest young way for a man to gain status. Women ululated and cheered for their saviours. Military honour and courage were celebrated in the Benin Bronzes, the Epic of Sunjeta, and Ganda culture. Whether societies were organised by kinship or age mates like the Maasai, group competition motivated militarism. By saving their communities from capture, co-ethnic men may have become revered as vital protectors. Now, intersectionality is really critical here. I'm specifically stressing co-ethnic men. We should not expect inter-ethnic slave raiding to have caused generalized fraternity or reverence for all men. Non-ethnic men may be viewed as dangerous threats, just like Nan and One Chekron suggest. Attitudinal surveys usually examine gender bias rather than this kind of intersectionality I'm talking about. So it's hard to test my hypothesis that slave raiding increased co-ethnic men's status. But support for male leaders does seem especially strong in Nigeria, which was really hard hit by the slave raids. 75% of Nigerians strongly agree that men make better political leaders. And that's reflected in electoral outcomes. And that holds for both Muslims and Christians, though Muslims more so. Now, ethnic religious fragmentation may have also weakened women's movements. In Eastern and Southern Africa, civil wars and especially post-conflict nation building have provided opportunities for women's movements to press for gender quotas. Eager for donor funding, authoritarians have often used quotas to strengthen international legitimacy. But women's campaigns for gender quotas have been far weaker in West Africa. I suggest that they have been hampered by ethno-religious fragmentation. Women who primarily identify with their ethnicity may have little appetite for such campaigns, since she is loyal to her ethnicity. An Igbo woman may be preferred to be led by an Igbo man rather than a house or woman. Even if women privately support gender quotas, distrust may dampen willingness to invest in sustained mobilization across ethnicity. Activism then becomes sporadic. Okay, now let's talk about polygamy. Polygamy is pervasive across West Africa. Economists Dalton and Loon suggest this is because the transatlantic trade disproportionately exported enslaved men, created long periods with uneven sex ratios. Women may have then become polygamous co-wives. Analyzing demographic and health surveys, they find that, and I quote, Muslims tend to have more wives than people of other religions, like Christians. And they suggest this is because Islam allows up to four wives, while Christianity forbids polygamy. Now, polygamy may have been initially encouraged by the transatlantic slave trade, but it was subsequently idealized by the jihad slave states. The Sokoto Caliphate seized enslaved women to become wives and concubines. Enslaved women were valued for both farming and fertility. Polygamy gained prestige, emulating the prophet and marking men's military might. Enslaved men were not actually permitted wives. So polygamy isn't just permitted by Islam, it also signifies status. And I think that helps explain its cultural persistence among Muslims. Now, polygamy generates cultural barriers to gender equality. Women in polygynous countries marry 5.1 years earlier and have 2.2 more children than those in monogamous countries, finds Michelle Tertilt. By marrying earlier and bearing more children, women are then economically disadvantaged. Polygamous unions can also be fraught with conflict and competition. As I was frequently told during my 9 months of research in the Gambia. Bright Opuku and Hikoro's analysis of demographic and health surveys suggests that polygamy is a major predictor of intimate partner violence across sub-Saharan Africa. Yet despite all these risks, women may feel unable to refuse. Aissatou worked extremely long hours for many years as a nurse, built a large house, only to discover that her husband had taken a younger wife. She was absolutely distraught, but felt totally powerless. In Burkina Faso, husbands may also threaten their wives with unwanted polygamy in order to enforce obedience. Okay, bride prices are usually paid in African countries that are polygamous. By selling their daughters, fathers can actually procure additional wives. Poor young men are thus competing with older established men. This generates inflationary pressures on bride prices. Moreover, Gambian women usually seek men who can provide financially. Poor young men then feel immense struggle and sadness, as they shared with me. So let me share some more quotes. So Francis was a 34-year-old woodcarver who had lost their girlfriend to an arranged marriage because, and I quote, he was not yet strong enough and they would not wait. Solomon, who was 27, wanted to marry his girlfriend, and I quote, but he was not that much strong and not ready to handle myself or someone else, even myself. To take care of myself is a problem, he told me. Then Mohammed, a 24-year-old chef, electrician and plumber, said, if you're chasing a girl, before she will accept, she will like to know whether you are strong or not. They don't care for boys unless you get. That is the main problem here in the Gambia, between boys and girls. And then this is from Abdouli, who's a 30-year-old woodcarver. And he shares a bed with a male friend because he can't afford his own bed. He says, they will underrate you because you've got nothing to give. So in polygamous societies, grooms must acquire enough resources in order to marry, or they must find much younger women. And that results in very large spousal age gaps. Michelle Tertilt finds that in polygamous societies, brides are usually 6.4 rather than 2.8 years younger than their husbands. Now, in Burkina Faso, a man marries a wife, not the other way around. A good wife then endures. That's the term they use in Mandane. By paying the bride price, the husband gains ownership of the children. And indeed, West Africans typically say that the child belongs to the father. they are not her lineage. Across Africa, women farmers are often less productive. This is because they're less able to command labour. In Niger and northern Nigeria, women are disadvantaged both in terms of land ownership and wealth in people, because their children are not their own. Polygamy is especially high in northern Nigeria. Poor young men struggle to compete with established older men and afford high bride prices. And that may be contributing to violent conflict, such as the Salafist jihadist group Boko Haram, which has killed over 35,000 people and 2 weeks ago, in March 2024, abducted hundreds of women and girls. To recruit poor young men, Boko Haram actually offers inexpensive weddings. Okay? So today, parents are calling for the return of their daughters and children. So let me summarise. Sub-Saharan Africa suffers from low agricultural productivity. Land was undifferentiated and abundant. The tsetse fly killed cattle while labour was scarce. Prosperity depended on wealth in people. Foreign and internal slave trades amplified demand, resulting in centuries of slave raiding and militarisation. Polygamy appears to have been encouraged by the transatlantic slave trade and the jihad states, and this inhibits gender equality through early marriage, high fertility, lineage, intimate partner violence, and intergroup violence. Women are then quadruply disadvantaged. The transatlantic slave trade and relentless slave raiding also appear to have bolstered co-ethnic solidarity and male status. This could explain why cabinets are male-dominated in African countries where ethnicity is heavily politicized. The Gulf of Guinea was especially hard hit by slave raiding and is overwhelmingly ruled by men. Ghana's parliament is 85% male. The Central African Republic's parliament is 89% male. Nigeria's parliament is 96% male. And in some respects, Africa is not unusual. Terrified civilians usually want big, strong patriarchs. When people are under attack, they typically seek macho leaders. Geopolitical conflicts and terrorist attacks generally erode public support for women. Cross-country regressions and natural experiments confirm this broader trend. Peace and security are hugely important pathways for gender equality in Africa and worldwide. Thank you very, very much for listening. I'm Dr. Alice Evans, and this is Rocking Our Prayers. And if you'd like to get in touch to discuss any of these ideas, hypotheses, please let me know. On my Substack, there are all the references, and there's a list of further readings. There's also a very exciting book coming out in August this year, 2024, How to Become a Big Man in Africa, by Wale Adinbanwe. So I look forward to reading that. So take care, and wishing you all the best. Thank you.